Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Episode 113 of the Keith Law Show. We're going to do a little baseball talk today with Justin Havens, who's my colleague for several years at ESPN when we both worked on Baseball Tonight. Neither of us with them anymore. So we're going to spend 25 minutes slagging our old employer. No, we're actually not going to do that. We just talk baseball, I promise. For those of you waiting for my prospect rankings, they will begin to run on Monday, January 30th, with the top 100. The current schedule has the just missed list and then the farm system rankings running at some point later that week. And then the team-by-team top 20s will run the following week, one division a day, starting on February 6th, running through the 11th, and then February 12th, we all watch the Eagles win the Super Bowl. For those of you who follow me for or are interested in board game content, I did have a new review go up over at Paste Magazine earlier today. Actually, I'm recording this on the 24th. I reviewed the game Rear Window from Funko Games, which was a little bit of a disappointment because I love the movie Rear Window. I'm a big Hitchcock guy. I mean, I know it's a bit cliche, right? If you like movies, you should like Hitchcock. If you like movies and you don't like Hitchcock, then you don't really like movies. And I thought Rear Window would be a bit of a different experience, but it is more guessing than deduction. You can read my review to understand exactly why I go into kind of a lot of detail of why I think it doesn't work as a cooperative mystery game. I like games like that. This one turned out to be a little too opaque to pull that off, and you end up, like I said, you end up guessing a bit, and I just think they didn't quite get the balance right necessarily. The art looks great, though. It does. They have folks from the original movie, some art related to the original movie. I loved that. I love when Funko, they acquire a lot of licenses and do that, but the game itself didn't really come together for me. And finally, before we get to the interview, just to throw it out there, some of you know that I'm a big movie guy. My wife and I every year try to see all of the Oscar nominees. I have a lot of thoughts on this morning's nominations. I'm not going to go into any great depth here. We'll just generally say I can't believe the Blue People got a Best Picture nomination. Now, I haven't seen it, so I guess it's possible it's that great of a movie, but I doubt it. I really doubt. I certainly doubt it's one of the 10 best movies of the year. The snubbing of Decision to Leave, not just in Best Picture, but in Best International Film, where it was not just submitted by South Korea, but made the 15-film shortlist, is absolutely appalling to me. That's a top 5 movie for me so far among 2020 movies. So just speaking of what's eligible for the Oscars. And so is After Sun, which I was very glad to see Paul Mescal get a Best Actor nomination. He was more than worthy. That's a wonderful film. If you have a chance to watch, it's rentable basically on all the streaming services. After Sun is also a top 5 movie for me from last year. It's really close to perfect. It's a small movie. It is not incredibly ambitious, and that's about the only bad thing I can say about it. It's really pretty wonderful. It should have gotten a Best Picture nomination. There was no chance of it doing that, but to see it get a Best Actor nomination, I was pretty pleased. Oh, and I guess one final thought. I'd never heard of To Leslie until this morning. I think I'm not alone in that. But yeah, I did about a triple take when that showed up. I was watching some of it live and just had a, wait, what? Moment when that came through. Now it is my pleasure to be joined by my former colleague at ESPN. He worked on Baseball Tonight with me, Justin Havens, who up until very recently was also working for Major League Baseball and their social arm, doing a lot of work on podcasting. He's also previously did some podcasting for Starting Nine. And he is a big baseball rat. I think that's probably the best way to describe you. So, and that's why I'm having him on. So Justin, thank you so much for joining me.
This is great. Thank you for having me. I've been a listener of your podcast the entire time you've been with The Athletic, or the entire time that it's existed. You know, I'm a huge fan, not only a fan, but a friend. And it's been a long time since we've talked baseball. So I'm looking forward to it. Yes, too long.
Absolutely too long. So we are mostly going to talk baseball, though we can certainly talk lots of other things.
Yeah, no doubt.
But here in the depth of the hot stove, as we were just sort of messaging back and forth, I asked what you were hottest on, and I'm going to read a quote here from your email, which I think is really a good starting point. You said, "I can't shake the fact that the Rangers have invested a ton of money in three guys while the rest of the roster feels short of being ready for those investments." I tend to agree. Why don't you elaborate a little bit on that,
sure,
on how especially how you view not just the rest of the roster, but also what do you think of those three big investments? I don't know that I feel like those are the right three guys necessarily to put the big pile of money into.
I agree. I think like nobody who's listening to this podcast needs me to talk about how great Jacob deGrom is. But like on a per start, on a perhaps two, maybe one or two of the seasons over the 5-year deal, you're going to get some of the most sublime pitching that anybody in the game is capable of delivering, either like present pitchers or historically. But I'm with you. It feels like those three were the guys they invested in, those three being DeGrom, Corey Seager, and Semien, because they were the ones who were available and maybe willing to take the money in those given off seasons. And while they undoubtedly make the team better, it doesn't feel like it's the, and I hate to criticize a team for spending money, because as I get older as a baseball fan, like the one thing that really resonates with me is teams that are willing to invest in the product and get better on the field. And so I admire them for doing that, but it doesn't feel like the rest of the roster was ready for the infusion of talent and the, where those three are on the age curve. That it is. They have $91.5 million wrapped up in those three. If you take those three and add basically the rest of the pitching staff, which is Perez, Eovaldi, Gray, and Heaney, that's $155 million. So you're at a point where they're seventh in payroll overall entering 2023. Mm-hmm. And while, again, that's a good thing, but it doesn't feel like it leaves them a lot of upward mobility in terms of added payroll, which you're going to inevitably need to supplement this roster, I think, because even though they've laid out these expenditures, it's a totally incomplete team. They were 38 games back of the Astros last year. They were 22 back of even the Mariners. So it's not like it's just an Astros problem. And as I think we'll talk later, like I think the Mariners got appreciably better, or can be expected to be appreciably better than they were last season. So it's kind of like a dual problem thing where, like, yes, there are certain young players on the team that I think you can build in some expected improvement for. You talked about that, I know, in your DeGrom Rangers article on The Athletic, but I don't think it's enough. And I don't think there are enough of those players to overcome the fact that above and beyond the risk that those three are not contributing at a star level. Like we saw how that can hamstring the Rangers season when Corey Seager got off to, by his standards, the brutal start that he had through the first two or three months of the season.
Mm-hmm.
Semien was certainly not the same player that he was in 21 that he was in 22. So like you need all of these guys to be fully functional to have a chance. And there's just an enormous amount of risk built in with all three, I think. So I just, too much too soon maybe is the, is the too long didn't read version. Yeah.
Yep. What I think is, because obviously I'm in the midst of my prospect writing at this point, actually finished capsule 75 out of 100. I'm very big on, like, I get very locked in on, like, I hit a good round number here too, and I feel much more accomplished. And it's like, I need to get this much done before I can talk to Justin today. So I did, which is good. But in the Ranger system, to me, they'll have a couple guys in the top 100. Their system is, I think, kind of deep. But I don't know that there are a lot of stars in there. And I wonder if some of this was, you know what, we're going to produce a lot of big leaguers. We may not produce any sixes and certainly any sevens. You could maybe squint and see Evan Carter turning into that. He's made a lot of improvements and he was an amateur. But I think he's first of all, he's very young and he's still got a couple of things he has to do. He's not getting the big leagues tomorrow, right? So to your point about timing, I wonder if they just looked and said, hey, we got to get some stars. A, the team's going to be not very watchable in the short term. And B, to me, that's a strategy, right? We are
are, you know, obviously everyone wants to develop stars, but you look at your system and say objectively, we like our farm system. We may not have any stars. We're just going to produce a lot of, you know, average or better, slightly better big leaguers. Let's get some stars in place, and then our farm system will fill in around them. I like that, but I wonder if you, to what you said, was this too much too soon? Did they jump? Less so with Seager, because I still think Seager was young and better in the second half.
The least problematic of the three by far, I think.
Totally agree. And frankly, I would even pile in some of the pitchers on that too, where it's like, yeah, I'm not really worried about Seager. I'm worried about a lot of the other investments. And it's not even that they're going to – we're not saying any of these guys are going to suck. It's just – when you've committed that much money, that much of a percentage of payroll, it's not about the dollars, but you've started to reduce your flexibility. If a bunch of these pitchers do what they've done recently, which is get hurt, they pitch really well, and then they're on the injured list for 40% of the season, you're kind of stuck.
Yeah.
And I agree with you that division's tough. And the Angels are going to miss the playoffs because they always do, but they're not going to be a pushover. There's one bad team in that division, and that really makes the Rangers' task even harder to me.
For sure. Context is important with what they're competing directly against. And like, I guess if I want to spin it on the optimistic side, and you sort of hinted at it with Corey Seager, like there's a lot to support statistically the idea that Corey Seager is going to be better in 23 than he was on the whole in 22. Like that, if you look at just what he did basically over the final 3 months of the season, which whatever, arbitrary endpoints and all of that. But like he was in a new situation. And in the second half of the season, he was much more like the Corey Seager that we've come to expect. If to whatever weight you give stats, like, you know, the gap between your expected WOBA and your actual WOBA and stuff like that, he was one of the league leaders in the gap in the wrong way. Right. So I think there's, and then, you know, I know there's a lot of speculation that I guess we'll see what impact the shift has on individual players, but you know, there's the potential that Corey Seager could be a guy who gets a little bit of a marginal bump from that as well. So I think there's, if there is a way for the Rangers, it's that Corey Seager's playing at, you know, kind of a down or mid ballot MVP level, I think is possible.
I'd buy that.
But, and that DeGrom is competing at a Cy Young level, which is also possible, but to have both of those align same season while also exactly right. Like it probably will happen in one individual season for both those guys over those 5 or 6 year deals, but to have them happen in the same year is kind of what the Rangers need. And that's the problem.
Yep. Agreed. They will be more watchable. And I do, I like that. You know, that is, I completely agree with you that watching these teams put the money, watching the teams who are willing put the money in, we should just generally say, hey, I'm glad they're spending. You mentioned the Mariners.
From the aesthetic angle of watchability, like obviously Jacob DeGrom is more watchable than the rest of the team combined, right? Like he's now in appointment.
Oh my God. Yeah. He's must see TV. Yeah.
Appointment viewing. And that's equally, that's doubly important because I find, This is not important in reality, but I find their stadium, the viewing experience of the stadium on TV to be among the worst in the sport. It feels like a mausoleum at times, and it just feels like very dark. And you know, that's the perspective of the person who watches way too much baseball.
Have you been to the stadium? I have never been to Globe Life.
I have not been. Nope.
So there's a college tournament there. Early in the college season, I'm going to go for that because obviously I don't travel much for major league stuff. It's just not my job.
Yeah, sure.
And so, you know, I'm going to more exciting places like Beloit. I'm going to get some mad, angry tweets about that one. Anyway, the point being, I am going to actually see the stadium for the first time. I think there's 3 stadiums left that I have never seen any game in whatsoever. And I'll hit 2 this year, Globe Life and then Seattle. And I think not, that will
lead Seattle's on my list too. Yep.
So they were building. I had a summer internship when I was in grad school in Seattle as they were building Safeco. And I was like, I'll get back at some point. That was 24 years ago.
I guess I'm finally getting there.
Yeah. Yes, it really does. Yep. I made a whole teenager in that time who is now driving, which is terrifying.
Oh boy.
Speaking of Seattle, so one of the questions I posed to you before is, are there Mariners set to improve? They made a bunch of small moves this winter, and I'm not saying they necessarily needed to make a large move, but I wondered if they would, right? They just got into the playoffs last year. It was a good, great season, good October for them. Obviously, they had the longest playoff drought. Now they don't. But I wondered if there was a big splash coming, and they didn't. But you mentioned before you feel like they have made significant improvements. So defend yourself.
Yes, I will. I, you know, Jerry DePoto's trade games have become like, you know, its own inside baseball thing. And I'm not, I think a lot of them pass by my window, and it's just like, eh. But I think on the whole, this offseason, they made mm-hmm. incremental improvements almost across the board. And I think when you combine that with some of the reasons for optimism for people who are already on the roster, I think it's totally reasonable. I think expecting them to close the gap with them and Houston is optimistic, even with the Justin Verlander departure. But I really do think that the Mariners are, you know, here to stay in the AL West. It feels like we're always talking about, are the Mariners sustainable? Because they won 86 games with a negative 85 run differential. You know what I mean? It feels like the Mariners are the kings of that season. That wasn't the case last year. Like, they outscored their opponents by 60, whatever runs. So you got the way that it lines up, at least as I'm seeing it, is that you're replacing Carlos Santana with AJ Pollock. I think that's mostly a wash. I'd probably rather take my chances with AJ Pollock this year, but I don't think that's all that meaningful. You're replacing Haniger, and they really only got a little under, 250 plate appearances from Haniger last year with Teoscar, who, like, the Teoscar Hernandez acquisition reminds me, if not in exact shape, then motivation and thinking to the Eugenio Suarez acquisition from the prior offseason, where like, you have a guy who showed, like, we'll say, like, low level all-star production in previous years, and then had kind of a decline. And Teoscar is a better player than I think Suarez is, and didn't show that level of collapse. But I think the same thinking's in play here, where he's a better player than he showed last season. And I do believe that's the case with Teoscar. And then you've got the Colton Wong, Adam Frazier, swap, where, like, to me, that's a clear, at least on paper, upgrade when you factor like, Wong was a full win plus better in fewer plate appearances last year than Frazier. And there's nothing about either one of their performances that seemed totally out of whack or why that wouldn't continue last year. And then, like, you get a full season of Luis Castillo, which I think is probably as important as all of the offensive incremental moves combined.
I agree.
And, you know, like, I don't know what Jared Kelnick is going to have to do in the major leagues for me to, like, be completely off of it, but it's going to have to happen in a much larger, more sustained sample than it's happened so far. Like, I know he was basically brutal when he came back up in 22 again. And, like, no matter how you splice the stats or do, you know, game logs or whatever, it was bad. But Jesse Winker also wasn't really very good last season. And I think I'd rather take my chances with internal improvement and more playing time from Kelnick than I would with trotting out, you know, kind of a cooked veteran again. So I think, like, I don't think it's a wholesale, you know, 5, 6, 7 win improvement, but I do think this team is better than it was last year. And again, that's as much about Castillo as it is about anything they did this year. But I think they were all, if not marginal steps forward, then at least treading water.
There's a good argument for it, right? The team's pretty good. We're expecting some internal improvement from guys we already have. So identify smaller areas of weakness and improve them. You know, if you improve 3 or 4 of them slightly, the Wong one is the most interesting one too, where his defensive numbers were way down last year. And I mean, I even saw interviews where people asked him about it. And he kind of acknowledged, like, I've not played my best. This was a guy who was a really good defensive second baseman for a while. And if he even just splits the difference, right, between where he was 2 years ago and where he was last year, then the volume of upgrade they just achieved there is even bigger. And they do still have their system is obviously depleted by trades and a lot of promotions, but there's still some stuff coming too, where you can look and say they might even get some in-season help. You know, maybe a Bryce Miller comes up and helps, even if he's a starter in the minors, but the kind of guy who could come up and help out of the bullpen later this upcoming season, for example. Like, I think they're pretty well positioned. I don't know that that catches the Astros, right? The Astros are just really, really good. But if you're one of those teams, if you're the Padres chasing the Dodgers, I think the same thing applies. You just say, we're going to put together the best team we can, you know, hope we've got a 95 win team on paper. And if that's only second place in that division, it's largely out of our control. but you want to be prepared in case the team ahead of you just has that one year where guys get hurt, stuff goes wrong. I feel like Seattle's probably put themselves in position to say that. If the Astros only win 92 games this year because disaster strikes, the Mariners are ready.
No question. And we haven't even talked about like the potential development next step that Logan Gilbert or George Kirby could take too. Like their rotation is not fully formed, right? Like, yes, Luis Castillo and having him for a full year is the most important part. And, you know, to what extent do we trust Robbie Ray? I'm not really sure, but it could matter less and less for this team, right? Like Robbie Ray is probably the fourth best starter already on this team. And that's a great spot for him to be in, frankly, contract aside. And I lean optimistic on both Gilbert and Kirby from what they showed last season. And I think that there's a scenario where like this rotation is, you know, top three, top four in the AL. I think it could be very exciting.
Yeah. Just looking at Gilbert is probably about where I think he'd be. And I love Gilbert. You know, I don't know that there's a big step forward there. It wouldn't shock me if he improved off of this, but this is about the pitcher I was hoping he'd be, especially when he came out for folks who don't remember his draft year, his velocity was kind of off. He came out of the Cape Cod League the previous summer and this guy might be a top 10 pick. Comes out the next spring, his velocity's down. Turned out he had mono, lost a bunch of muscle, you know, just wasn't the same guy. Mariners get him out the next year and boom, velocity's back. He's just the guy he used to be. And he was always a good command, good delivery guy. Like, I think you've seen probably close to peak Logan Gilbert. Kirby, on the other hand, you know, just 50 more innings of the same.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Yep.
Yeah. Right. And I think there's still more, like he might miss more bats. He is their best strike thrower and I think will probably continue to be so, but he's really young, he's not very experienced. There could be quite a bit more there. Would not surprise me if we looked up at the end of the season and said, oh, Kirby was actually their second best starter, right? Castillo, you just assume will be the best. Wouldn't surprise me if Kirby just leapfrogs Gilbert. Nothing against Gilbert, but Kirby has room for improvement there, which I think is one of their best potential opportunities for internal improvement as opposed to the external guys we just discussed.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Don't just ride the index, seek to outperform it with Fidelity Active ETFs. Learn more at fidelity.com/active ETFs. Before investing in any exchange-traded fund, you should consider its investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Contact Fidelity for a prospectus, an offering circular, or if available, a summary prospectus containing this information. Read it carefully. While active ETFs offer the potential to outperform an index, these products may more significantly trail an index as compared with passive ETFs. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.
Just real quick, I know we didn't talk much about the Angels beforehand, but do you give them any chance? I mean, is this another Mike Trout? What's the joke? Mike Trout hit 3 home runs, Shohei Ohtani punched out 12, and you know, the tungsten arm O'Doyle tweet, and the Angels lost 7-5.
It's not totally
it just
fair.
Looks like them again.
Yeah, it's not totally fair, but mentally I've already sort of fast forwarded to the Shohei Ohtani trade sweepstakes. And how that's going to play out, because this is not an objective stats answer. I'm ready for Shohei Ohtani to play, and I would say Mike Trout too, but it seems less likely that he's dislodged from the Angels. I'm ready for Shohei Ohtani to play on a team that matters and that is not like an active, the Angels have at this point become like a shockingly depressing team for having two of the five best players in Major League Baseball. I don't give them much of a chance. I like the Tyler Anderson signing as an individual move. I think I know there were some snickers where it's like, oh, they're the Angels are signing a Dodgers guy, like this is going to go poof, right? Everything that the Dodgers do right, the Angels won't be able to replicate. But I do think for, you know, pitch mix reasons and stuff like that, I think there's optimism for Tyler Anderson to repeat a lot of what he did last year. I think they needed his quantity as well, because
oh, for sure.
when Shohei is your most reliable, like I just don't think it's fair to ask that Shohei Ohtani is your most reliable pitcher from a quantity standpoint. You know what I mean?
Right? Like it's not realistic.
He probably will be. And he's, you know, one of the right. five or six best pitchers in the AL when he's at his best. But that's a lot to ask of one man. And so I think that was an important signing. I just don't think it comes anywhere near closing the gap between what they need to do with, like, to me, they're more of a Rangers team than mm-hmm. they are a Mariners or even Astros situation. You know, the decline of Anthony Rendon is to me like one of the single most significant, like, player team inflection points of the last 5-10 years, because if he's still an all-star caliber player and is playing, like, not only has he not been good on a rate perspective, but he hasn't really been available for them either. And
right,
the whole idea of that sort of stars and scrubs setup is that the stars play. And that's just been an enormous sinkhole of money. And it feels like every time the Angels open up that contract slot, that it's just devoted to somebody who just completely sidetracks what they're trying to do, whether that's, you know, going all the way back to Hamilton or CJ Wilson, or, you know, the better part of Pujols' deal. It's just, yeah, I'm out basically.
Their depth chart, I just pulled it up. I mean, it is depressing, right? There's a
how
lot
is it
of
this
guys
bad
this
still?
Team.
Keith, how is it still this bad? Like,
right? Like they have a bunch of starters who are not starters, right? Or who at best, I'm talking about the position players, not even the rotation here, who just would not start for a majority of teams. Probably wouldn't start for more than about 10 teams in baseball, which is fine if you are a bad team. And you're like, we're trying some guys out, some, you know, internal options, some minor league, you know, 6-year free agents, etc. But my God, that is, I mean, they could have six. Even if I'll set Rendon aside, because I think you can't tease apart that he's been bad and he's been hurt. Maybe those two things are together
for sure,
or connected.
No doubt.
But my God, there's like six spots in that lineup that are just like, that is how is that still possible?
On every year, you know, they become irrelevant by August. And I'm like, all right, well, I'll pay attention to them for Trout and Ohtani reasons, but they're done now. And I always hope that when December and January rolls around and, you know, your prospect rankings come out and I'm like, all right, tell me that there's like this surge of Angels minor leaguers coming up that I didn't know was happening, and that they all busted, you know, they all broke through on the second half of the season or whatever. And it's never true. Like, like Renfro, not to pick on these guys, but Renfro, Drury, Walsh, these guys to me are people who are better. They're fine. They should all be on a team. They can all play roles, but they're all going to be overtaxed on this team. And I mean, Walsh already has been overtaxed, I think, with what the quantity of playing time they've asked from him. So I'm just, unfortunately, I think it's kind of DOA a little bit for the Angels again this season.
It's frustrating. It is frustrating. Very frustrating. As somebody who wants to see, I want to see Trout and Ohtani in the playoffs. And
they're
maybe
the single
see Ohtani
most frustrating
this year.
Team from a neutral fan perspective of, I mean, arguably my lifetime, because I guess if I'd been a little bit older during some of the Barry Bonds Giants roster construction era, where they were just not getting it done for him, you know, with the rare exceptions of when he basically forced them through the playoffs. But like, other than that, this is as bad as it gets, because it was bad enough when it was Trout. And then they were, you know, I think I remember at the time being the fact that Ohtani signed with the Angels was at least mildly surprising. And it's just like, you get another guy, another generational player, and he's also going to be wasted in even a more spectacular fashion than Mike Trout's prime was wasted. Right. And it's like, that's your encore. It's actually not improving the team. It's wasting an even more more unique talent, right?
Yes, right? Yeah. you think we may wasted Mike Trout's peak years? Hold my beer.
Exactly.
Yes. Two teams that I wonder if they should have done more, and I think the fan bases of both, just based on sort of what I'm seeing, hearing a little bit, that they didn't do enough. The fans feel like they didn't do enough. You know, one, the Pirates, who I'm surprised Brian Reynolds is still on their roster. And two, I don't think I was alone in thinking this would be the time the Orioles would go out and spend on some pitching, and they really didn't. So pick one, both, wherever you do. You agree with those sentiments that both of those teams should have done something like that this offseason, assuming that the offseason is basically done. We're not likely to see a ton more activity.
I guess I'm not surprised that they didn't do something, but in the case of the Orioles, I'm disappointed, I think is is the way that it works. Like I'm the Pirates to me are as unserious of a franchise as exists outside of Oakland, I think is the easiest way to put it. And it, like, you know, Tampa at least wins games. This team is just like the Andrew McCutchen reunion tour seemed to be their plan for the offseason. And that's kind of what it is. The Brian Reynolds thing, like you're much more aware of the trade market than I am. I think that's exceedingly surprising, especially with the rumors of the extension that they offered him, or whether that's true or not, I'm not sure. But like, it doesn't seem like they're valuing him for an extension, right? So it's surprising that they wouldn't trade him. But for the Orioles, to me, are much more disappointing, because you're talking about an 83-win team that like sort of semi-intentionally put on the brakes leading up to the trade deadline, right? And prioritized, I don't think incorrectly, but prioritized, cashiering some assets for, you know, the long term, and kind of not prioritizing a wild card run in 22. That's fine. But the moves this offseason have left a lot to be desired. And I think it's, you have this offensive core that is potentially not only really good, but really interesting and really affordable. Like obviously Adley and Gunnar Henderson was in the amount that I got to watch him down the stretch last year. Very exciting. That seems like he's all in. Total package.
And he keeps getting better. Like I saw him early 21, late 21, early 22. It's like, oh, this guy just keeps getting better. Every time he moves up, or even within a stint at a level, he gets better. His body's better, his swing is better, his defense is better. I mean, I keep saying he's like Scott Rolen at third base. Like,
it seems like there's some real helium on his stock over the last like year and a half.
I think all of us, it was interesting, because I see a lot of them just by virtue of where I live, but I still talk to other scouts too. And one guy I can think of, one scout in particular, who was like, yeah, he can play shortstop, but have you seen this guy at third base? Like, holy shit, this guy's really, really good at third base, like maybe elite defense. And I'm thinking, you know, what if you had a Nolan Arenado type, right? And Arenado was another one who flipped the script entirely on his defense, where it was like, yeah, he's really, really good at third, but also you can go stand at short for a week and he's not going to hurt you at all. Like, that's pretty good defensive player who's also got some stick.
For sure. And like, you know, Cedric Mullins is now more properly slotted as like your third or fourth best offensive, like overall position player. And so like, then you've got Ryan Mountcastle. So like you asked a like breakout players potential. And I think Mountcastle is on a short list for any sort of breakout potential. You look at like the largest gap between slugging and expected slugging. He had the largest gap in the wrong way among qualified hitters last year. He was eighth in MLB in barrels per plate appearance. And the guys that were ahead of him, Judge, Jordan, Trout, Stanton, Schwarber, Ohtani, and Riley. So like there's a lot of, I mean, like his traditional numbers are going in the wrong way. So you pull up his baseball reference page and you're like, well, he lost like 70 points of OPS last year. Yeah. Like, what the hell are we talking about here? But I do think like there's a lot of batted ball data that supports the fact that Ryan Mountcastle. And then I looked up Zimborski's Zips projection for him earlier this week. And like, it's much more in line with what he put up two seasons ago than it was last year. So I think like when you factor in that breakout potential with the breakouts that have already occurred on this team, I'm totally with you. The fact that there was no pitching investment, and like, so Justin Verlander would have been a great fit on this team, right? Yeah. I think we're both on the same page that Justin Verlander was probably not going to seriously consider the Baltimore Orioles unless what $55 million a year or something that was clearly. Right. Yeah. So like, but Carlos,
here's
Rodon,
the keys to Baltimore. Yeah.
Yeah.
But Rodon would have been right.
So like, and I get it. Like, the Orioles have never been a team that have invested necessarily in those sorts of deals, particularly like for a pitcher with that level of injury concern. But now feels like the time where you would have done that, because the other pitchers on that roster are like, I know Dean Kramer's solid and his projections looking decent, and like Grayson Rodriguez and DL Hall, like you've got arms coming. Like, so now's the time to pay Carlos Rodon $20 million a year to come in and give you, you know, elite 140, 150 innings a year.
Yeah.
Or at least in some seasons, and hope that they're the right seasons. But I think I'm with you. This is, I thought you'd get a little bit more build coming off of last year with the Red Sox not really being a force within that division, the Rays losing whatever it was, 14, 15 games off of their win total from two seasons ago. It felt like there was an opportunity for them to be a legitimate wild card team. And maybe that still happens, but this was an opportunity to go get pitching, and there was pitching on the market too.
Well, this, I feel like, right, there's three ways to get pitching. There's three ways to get anything, but it's thinking specifically of pitching in the case of the Orioles, right? You draft it. Well, they don't. And that's a philosophy. And I think that a lot of that goes back to Elias and Sig and those guys when they were in Houston, right? They did try to draft pitching high, and it was a disaster. Appel, Aiken, even poor Forrest Whitley, who's, walking around with a black cloud over him. They've just clearly decided since getting to Baltimore, we're not drafting pitching, at least not high. That's fine. I understand that. That's a strategy. Yeah. Okay, fine. Or you sign it in free agency. Well, they're not doing that. You got to trade for it then. Yeah. And they haven't done that yet. They still could. It's the one thing. If we see any kind of hot stove activity between now and honestly, really opening day, it could still happen in spring training. We could see some trades. And the Orioles do have position player prospect surplus and a couple of big leaguers who could be surplus. They could trade for pitching. And that's the one team I keep looking at and thinking, you're not done. Most other teams that are trying are done. And I look at the Orioles and I think you should be trying to trade for pitching. I don't know if Pablo Lopez was really the right choice necessarily, but I hope the Orioles were at least in. They were on that and saying, make sure you talk to us before you do a deal, because we want one of your pitchers. They'd be the perfect fit, and they could pay a reasonable price that is fair for both sides, gets them the pitching they need, and give up value, but not players they're likely to miss because the Orioles have such incredible depth in position player prospects.
And I brought up Rodon as a guy who could fit comfortably at the top of that rotation. To me, they could have been swimming in a different part of the pool too. Like, they could have been swimming in the Taillon part of the pool, right?
Yes.
You could have used solid number four, 3.5 bulk innings too. Like, that would have fit on this roster as well. And it's not like he broke the bank either, or a Taijuan Walker or whoever in that class of pitcher they wanted to pursue. There are lots of different shapes that could have fit in this rotation. The last thing I'll say on the Orioles is that part of it is a problem with that the Orioles didn't really improve. The other part of it is that if you look at the two teams that they trailed in, or two of the teams that they trailed in the wild card hunt, The Jays got better, who I do want to talk about at some point, and the Mariners got better, who we just talked about, and the Twins, who were just behind them, I think got marginally better as well. So all the teams, whether those are the teams that they're competing against in 23, who knows? But the teams that they were competing against in 22, I think, made clear-cut improvements, and the Orioles really didn't.
So you like the Varsho trade?
I do.
The Blue Jays? Yeah, I do too.
I think I'm more like your win-win characterization of that trade is where I'm at with that, but I'm more interested in the Varsho side because it's just more relevant right now,
And
we'll check in on Moreno in a couple of years or later this season. But, Varsho, depending on your defensive metric of choice, was either very good or elite defensively, right? He played all three outfield positions and some catcher. I know most of it was center field, but he got a little time in the two corners as well. It's not just him. He's the most impactful acquisition they made, but I liked the Chris Bassett signing as well. I think that they're, is exactly as good as he was last year? I don't know, but even if he's 85 or 90% of his 22, this rotation felt a lot more volatile all of a sudden than I think we might have anticipated a year ago. With Berrios' season and whatever you can get from Kikuchi and Ryu moving forward. Now you've got Manoah, Gausman, and Bassett, and it's we're locked in. Those are three guys that I can really count on who I think have a diverse and interesting complement of skills too. And definitely the least important of the transactions, but one I don't think it should be overlooked is Brandon Belt too, older now, injury prone. We're a full season or so removed from the last time he was an effective player, but we're talking about a guy with a career 124 weighted runs created plus and a 265, 361, 472 slash from 13 to 21. Like, to me, this is still a guy in the role that they're probably going to ask him to play. To the extent that we care about righty lefty balance, these acquisitions also even that out a little bit. for what was predominantly a right-handed lineup. I just think I think these are smart moves for a team that is trying to win baseball games right now in a division that I think they can win if things go their way in 23. So I really liked as a whole, like maybe the Verlander signing with the Mets was my single favorite transaction of the offseason, given who they got and what they were recovering from not getting. As a total package, I think the Blue Jays offseason might have been my favorite.
Yeah, and it's funny as I look at their system too, which they've traded a lot of guys, and they have obviously they've promoted a lot of guys. Their system has a lot of really interesting names. Almost nothing that's likely to help them this year, except maybe some pitching prospects who project as starters, but probably if we see them this year, it's relievers, Tiedemann, Zulueta, Younger, et cetera, guys who I don't think will start a game for the Blue Jays this year. Maybe it's a spot start, but not impact. Yeah, yeah. Like, they needed to do this at the major league level, right? And that is great. This is what you do, right? You build. Some prospects make your team and they make your team better. Some prospects you trade. And then eventually you get to that point where, okay, we don't have help coming. How can we supplement from outside? And if you did your job well, you're making more minor acquisitions, or you're trading, they had a ton of catching and you trade Moreno, who I still love. And as far as I know, they still love. They were like, we hated giving this guy up, but they got a player they really needed who also keeps Springer ever from seeing center field, which is probably good for everyone concerned.
For sure. And whatever you were going to get from Moreno as a spot catcher, you can just get from Varsho now himself, right? So, I know Kirk and Jansen are there, but like whatever flexibility Moreno would have allowed, you already have built in without.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm huge on what they did.
Before I let you go, you mentioned breakout guys, which I did warn you ahead of time, just so people don't think I'm springing this on you. But you mentioned Mountcastle. Was there anybody else who jumped out to you as a potential breakout candidate for this year?
So I have one kind of the guy who's made your prospect list that I think is on the verge of a breakout. A guy who's already received MVP votes that I think is just like we're as a national baseball community, we're on the verge of like his MVP performance, I think. So I'll go first one. Brian Bayo, I think, is a guy that we're going to see like a noticeable step forward from. You already sort of saw it last year. You look at what he did. It was a 4.71 ERA and 57 in a third innings in 13 appearances, 11 of which were starts. FIP, whatever. FIP has its drawbacks, right? We all know that. But whether you look at FIP or expected ERA, those numbers were either two runs or a run better than what his ERA put up. 2.94 FIP, 3.80 xERA. He had a 2.59 ERA, just normal ERA, over his last six starts of the season. And it looks like you're the scout, you can tell me, but it looks like from a statistical perspective, the changeup really played already. And batters had hit 158 off of it with a 44% whiff rate. And that to me is, his fastball got hit around, his sinker and fastball got hit around substantially. But I think this is a guy who showed a lot and looked like he was like kind of learning on the fly last year too.
I agree.
And making like start by start or, maybe non-linear, but improvements over the course of starts and in between starts. So he's on my short list for breakouts, at least as far as pitchers go.
Yeah, he's the only thing I'll add to that. I agree with you on pretty much everything you said there. The one thing, like, he's a guy where I wonder, and I just looked it up. He actually threw almost twice as many sinkers as he did four seamers. The four seamer, despite being really hard, I think I've seen him up to 99. It's pretty ordinary, and he left a lot of them up last year. If you just look at his heat map, pitch heat map too, there's a big red spot in the last place you really want it for a pitch that's like that. Like hitters, they're going to go after that, and they're probably going to hit it reasonably hard, which is he doesn't have to. He's got a full arsenal. He's got, if you count the sinker as a distinct pitch, he's got four other weapons. So he could really just, obviously, and this is a thing a lot of teams have worked with it on, so this is not wish casting. You just be like, no, you're throwing that one up, like at a guy's shoulder blades. And otherwise, we don't really want to see a lot of four seamers here unless you desperately need a strike. Like otherwise, you have a four pitch mix that you can work with. He'd probably just be a lot more effective doing nothing more than that, just working with the stuff that he already has.
Yeah, I'm interested to see what the sophomore season has. So him and Mountcastle are my two like actual breakout picks in terms of a guy who's already awesome that I think is going to take the next. I think Kyle Tucker, like we're on the verge of him being like an actual MVP. He's 15th. He got 15th in the AL MVP vote in 22 and 20th in 21. Yep. So I feel like we're not, and he didn't, I'm not saying he deserved to win the MVP in either of those seasons, but he's 10th among AL batters in WAR over the last 2 years. And it feels like, you know, like his kind of raw OPS slash line took a step back last year, but, you know, he was more active on the base paths. And it just feels like we're entering like the culmination of every element of his skill set. He was an impact player defensively last year, according to the metrics. And I just think with all the things that he does well, I think we're going to see a slash line that's closer to 21 than it was 22 with all of the good things that happened in 22 as well. So I think that's kind of my more my subjective gut reaction to where Kyle Tucker is going.
I buy it. I mean, for a guy who's got his kind of pounce, 30 homers exactly in each of the last 2 years and less than 100 strikeouts in each of the last 2 years. That's like, you're in the wrong era, buddy. Like hitters don't do that.
Totally. And like that, you know, I think it was a 15% strikeout rate each of the last two seasons. It's just like, there's so much. And like, I think he lost about 50 points on his balls in play average between 21 and 22 too. So for a guy who's striking out that infrequently, like, it just feels like there's going to be some bounce back there. And even if he's not a fundamentally better player than he was over the last two seasons, which I still think is possible, I just feel like everything's going to kind of coalesce. So,
Great pick.
Yeah. Yep.
So, thank you for writing my annual breakouts column for me. I really appreciate
that. Oh, no problem. I'm available anytime you need help like that.
Excellent.
Don't worry about it.
Yes. I'll hit you up at the draft. You can tell me who's going first overall.
Yeah. Out of my depth quickly, it seems like.
My guest today has been my longtime friend, former colleague, Justin Havens, most recently of MLB.com. We worked together at ESPN Baseball Tonight, and you can even follow him on Twitter. And I had your page open, and now I lost it because I do that. It is J-Hay-Kid, J-A-Y-H-A-Y-Kid. Justin, thank you so much for joining me.
Keith, it was a pleasure, man. I appreciate it, and I'll look forward to talking ball with you in the future.
That's all for this week's show. Thanks so much for listening. I will return probably next week. It may not be necessarily at the beginning of the week because obviously I'll be finishing up the top 100 and some of the associated content around that. But this show should be weekly as much as I can, at least into spring training. Travel can interrupt that a little bit. But the goal is to have this be weekly for the next couple of months at least. So if you are not currently a subscriber, if somebody passed this to you, you can subscribe iTunes, Spotify, Amazon, Stitcher, wherever you like to. And many, many of you have left positive comments and positive reviews on iTunes, especially. I really appreciate that. It does help spread the word about the show. Thanks so much for listening, everyone, and stay safe.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.